This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Sam and Gian. They're the hosts of the Twink Revolution podcast. Twinks, it's great talking to you.
Hey, how's it going, Robert? Thanks for having us.
Great. So can you give us some background information about yourselves, the podcast, and also the news site that publishes articles?
Yeah. So I guess we live in San Francisco, or Sam's in Oakland, but we sort of met a few years ago. Sam was a libertarian, I was a Marxist. Sam's now a Marxist. but he was the one who I think sort of had the inspiration to say, hey, let's actually do a podcast. There's a gap in the market here for a kind of whimsical gay version of politics. And so we started doing it. People sort of liked it, but then I think we also found that like the podcast format's a little bit limiting. So we also decided to start publishing. So we had this sort of twinkrev.com, and it's been really cool. We've been able to sort of get some other writers to come and write for us, just generally within the fold of like it's either a sort of materialist understanding of the world, or it's something kind of gay and fluffy, or a combination of both. And so that's been really good. The response has been great so far.
To what degree do you identify with LGBTQ politics, and do you still see like the struggle for gay rights as a crucial issue?
I think we feel included in a sense that we're both part of that community, but also very willing to acknowledge there is a multi-class conflict of the LGBT issues as a topic, because we don't really we're Marxist, so we care about working people. We don't care about LGBT billionaires or business owners. I would say we're very critical of the liberal LGBT sphere in the sense that it advances capital versus the interests of working people. What was the other question?
I think to that point, I mean, it's sort of it feels like some of those struggles that were very much about kind of material safety and just a basic access to society, they've been fought and won. And so I don't know. Yeah, it's not something that I perhaps organize my life around. I don't think Sam does either. Yeah. But we're sort of stupid homos, and that's as much identification as one really needs, I think.
Yeah. For the other question about do we still see a need to advance LGBT issues, I think absolutely. I think there's plenty of areas where LGBT issues could be advanced, but I think the best way to do much of that is through universal programs and like satisfying the material needs of everyone. So things like housing and healthcare and education, the things that actually are all the issues that really hurt the working class LGBT community that liberals love to talk about but never actually solve. Like the great examples, the like Black trans women, and they're like, oh, a lot of them get murdered, and it's because they don't have access to like safe jobs, they don't have access to housing, they don't have access to healthcare, so they have to resort to prostitution. And that's, I think, a problem. And I think universal programs is the way to actually save not just LGBT people, but like all working class people.
Oh yeah, there was that article about the Supreme Court ruling. I forget the legal details, but it was about a gay rights issue, and the point that was made in the article on your site was that the Supreme Court ruling had little benefit to workers' rights.
Yeah, that was my article. yeah, I think it's just anti-discrimination is clearly a good thing, but it doesn't do anything to guarantee you have a job or healthcare or anything like that. It just means they can't say, oh, you're gay, that's why I don't want to have you work here anymore. But they can make any other reason up. So it's very limiting, and I think we need to ask for more. Like, we need more for our security.
Yeah, I mean, the people, I think the sort of the liberal establishment was trumpeting this as a particular kind of victory. And yet it's not clear what material security it buys you. It's a sort of symbolic victory. It's not a material one.
There's also that review of the show called Queer Eye for the straight guy. I think that was on about a decade ago. And there is like the theme of gay acceptance, but it also has like a very pro-capitalist message.
Yeah. So that was another one of Sam's articles, although I kind of helped out with that one. So yeah, Queer Eye is this reboot of a show that Netflix did that, as you say, was on about 10 years ago. And whatever they sort of virtues the original show, which was just a classic makeover show of the 90s mold, where like, we're going to take, you know, one horrible loser per week and we're going to fix their horrible, sad life. You sort of take that, but then it's a bunch of like, the modern incarnation of it is a bunch of these like, gay bourgeoisie, you know, rich like elites going around to the hinterlands of America, sort of displaying the sad lives of these unfuckable losers and then, you know, trying to turn them into little good PMC adherents, and it's just sad to watch.
Oh yeah, you definitely like see the role, like, this is a theme on your podcast, but the role that class plays within gay culture, a couple of different examples and trends I've noticed is like pride parades kind of losing their edge and becoming more dominated by like, it's nothing but like woke capital, like Bank of America floats. And then like, I think the candidate Pete Buttigieg, like he really does kind of capture that, the demographic of like, PMC stands for professional managerial class, but neoliberal, but combined with like LGBTQ identity politics.
Right, which is incredibly vulgar. To the extent of yes, Mayor Peter or any of his adherents and the people who would be big boosters of his campaign. I mean, what on earth do they have in common with somebody who's like, I don't know, just working a regular retail job or something and happens to also be gay or trans or whatever? It's just like one is an elite and coddled by, you know, the military industrial complex in this country. The other one is a retail worker with absolutely no job security and probably, you know, sleeping in their car. Like, what is the shared experience there except a sort of a maybe a shared sexual interest occasionally, or coincident sexual interest?
Oh yeah, it just kind of coincides overall directions of the left. So obviously on the cultural angle, the trend is moving further to the left on, like, yeah, like called the Great Awakening, like the on that end, but on economics, Bernie was defeated, and Biden, who's obviously more neoliberal, is the nominee. So, I mean, what are the trends that you see on the left, the current trends, and what you expect to see going into the general election?
I would push back a little bit on the social issues moving farther to the left when I would claim they're actually fully intertwined with the neoliberal order. I mean, culture is downstream from our relation to the economy. So, of course, we're seeing identity be used as like a brand. It's your individualized persona, and that's how you market yourself in the economy and on Twitter and other social media platforms. I think the idea of culture being left is more just having it to liberate everyone, make sure everyone has material needs met. In regards to where I see the left going, I think Bernie was the last shot for electoralism to be a useful outcome for any worker gain. And I think we're probably going to see shit go downhill before it gets better. I do have some hope that there's maybe Marxist kind of scientific socialism resurging, but not as fast as I wanted to. Because it's so small, it's going to take forever. I think it's going to be there, like, Republicans in power for quite a while until an actual, like, materialist left emerges and actually connects with working class people.
Oh, yeah, because with woke identity politics, it is basically like your identity is not something more organic. It's basically like a brand that you purchase.
Yeah, no, it's exactly part of the idea or the logic of something that says that your entire value to society as a person is sort of either your labor value in terms of what can you sell or how can you produce profit for somebody else, or in this sort of weird woke metagame, which is sort of feels like a side quest for this sort of professional classes, is how can I sort of build a brand that will allow me to hold on to whatever little bit of material and economic security I've managed to sort of carve out for myself. And so what you're seeing there is most of politics, in terms of electoral politics, and even sort of like Twitter discourse games and all that sort of stuff, is sort of it's just a manifestation of that. It's a weird war between a strange in-group within what you might call the sort of upper middle classes. Not a real political contest.
Oh yeah, I saw that tweet that you posted. I think I forget if it was under the main Twink Rev account or Sam's, but you were talking about people you know in the Bay Area, like people of that PMC class. And yeah, I mean they'll definitely they'll show support for the George Floyd protests, but a lot of them have a little class interest. And one of you was saying that if you bring up like class-based political views, they'll actually react the same way they would to. I don't know if it'd be the same reaction as to like a Trump supporter, but maybe in that direction.
Yeah, I think once you mention class in any conversation that should have class incorporated, like LGBT issues or race or gender or anything like that, they instantly will snap on you and call you like a class reductionist or like a Knott's ball, or like even just like be like, oh, you shouldn't be talking about that right now, it's not relevant to the topic, because their entire analysis is from a liberal individualized framework. But also because so much of them, primarily in like the Bay Area, it goes against their entire like class interests. They're all highly educated or of high wealth income, and many are like tied into tech, so they don't view the world outside of the Bay Area as being like worth saving. I think it's often vulgar and deplorable and stuff like that. Everyone's uneducated and they just would rather they all go away.
Oh yeah, like the attitude towards like white poverty and like the deaths of despair that you see in a lot of like, it's mostly impacting like red states and what would be described as like flyover country. But when it comes to those issues like the death of despair and the opiate crisis, the reaction from a lot of people on the left, and the thing is it's not just the neoliberal kind of centrist types, it's people who would present themselves as progressives. Like it's pretty, I mean, their handling of this has been pretty sickening, and it basically represents like the most like social Darwinist capitalist mentality.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and it is sickening, and I think that's what's so sad, right, is that ground has been entirely seeded in terms of if you play the game and kind of use the right words or give the right propitiations to a kind of vulgar liberal identity politics, then you can get away with just saying the most disgusting things about actual humans who are suffering. And the idea that, yeah, you're just like, haha, I hope all these people die of corona. That's not a statement that should be ever cloaked in a nice, you know, oh, I'm the good political team. No, you're not. That's pure evil. That's just a horrible thing to say about anybody. And you know, even if our people, even if you disagree with the way people are behaving, that you just wish death on them for not signing up to your political project, that is a political project in your own class interest. I mean, how narcissistic can you get?
Yeah, it's awful. Like, they'll say that they hope those people, anyone who automatically voted for Trump should, like, lose any access to healthcare. But just kind of looking over, like, different groups within the left. So, you have the kind of center-left neoliberal types, the kinds of people who watch CNN or MSNBC and they have resist as a hashtag. And then they have, I guess, the groups. They're, I guess, progressive used to be a thing, but now progressive, that term's been co-opted by neoliberals. And then you have the group that came out of Bernie, like the Bernie supporters, which would include like the group that gets called Rochalist or Bernie Bros, and then the more like woke Bernie supporters. And then there's another group that's kind of somewhere in between called, they're sometimes on social media referred to as like rad libs, like AOC and like Warren supporters fit into that group. And I mean, the interesting thing you saw posted, because one of you posted this poll that showed a large portion of DSA members were actually relatively well off, but how would either of you describe that group, Radlibs or DSA?
Well, that was the, I think I posted it, was had a the Bellows had published a piece about I guess it was a 2017 membership survey of the DSA, and just showing that, I think it was high 20s or something percent had incomes over $100,000 a year, I think. I know. What do you think about Radlibs, Sam?
Well, I think all the groups you mentioned are all kind of the same group. I think the AOC is and the neolibs under Biden and stuff like that all actually hold the same political project. They all take society from an individualized, identity-based political analysis, and they all reject class as a framework that's actually worth addressing. And even if they do mention class, it always must have a million descriptors prior to it. It's always, oh, they're a POC, gay. It's kind of like thin. They will never actually mention like the vast majority of the working class who doesn't fit their woke politics. So like the coal miners in like West Virginia, who are primarily white, but also extremely poor and dying of like black lung and stuff. Like, they don't get discussed in that conversation because they can't utilize identity politics, they only can utilize class, and that's not politically popular. But also, the progressive project stems back to the progressive era, and that was a class war as well. It was a way for the upper classes to control primarily the immigrant and black communities, and they were really into eugenics and race language we see still utilized today, where all modes of like discussion of race are based in like this like fact that being a certain race or ethnic group is actually like scientifically based, or that we can actually measure it, or they want to create a standard of, we're going to give this money or support only to black people. But then you have to ask the question, oh, how do we decide who's black? Because then you're actually doing race science to decide who fits into this racial group, and that's really problematic.
Oh, yeah, but like there was a governor of Kentucky who, after the George Floyd... Yeah, right. In the very beginning of the George Floyd protests, he pushed legislation to give free health care, but only to African Americans. But why not make it available to everyone?
Exactly. Like, this is the problem.
Well, I mean, but part of it, there's a strange, there's a strange class tension going on here, which is to say that the vocabulary for talking about class in America is gone. So we tend to use race as a standard for class, but not just that. It's that there's a set of people who would like to co-opt what they imagine is their sort of their social, you know, lessers, their social inferiors, into their particular class war. And that's an upper class war. I mean, this is your sort of your rich shitheads basically thinking that they can give enough baubles or enough sort of political prizes to say, oh, you are African American, therefore I know your mind. Get into some good scientific racism on that, right? Like, because I know you're African American, I must know your politics and your political allegiances, and therefore I think you're co-optable into my particular coalition against the other, say, professional or managerial people who are competing for the same jobs as me.
And yeah, with the whole, like, with a class base left, the objective of a class-based left would be to unite working people of all racial backgrounds or cultural backgrounds. But right now, working-class black people and working-class whites are at odds with each other politically over the current issues going on with the that have emerged out of the George Floyd protests. So there's, you see the working class divided over that.
I don't think I quite buy the logic of a working class divide along racial lines. I mean, I think there are antagonisms that are perhaps real and which perhaps can be parsed along racial lines. But generally speaking, I feel like it's not, it doesn't actually, or rather it's doing a lot of heavy lifting in terms of your ability to actually understand the situation. Let's say that the antagonisms of one poor person who's sort of just living very precariously with a crappy job, no healthcare, no prospects of the future getting any better, if they are directing the hostility they feel as a result of that situation towards, say, African Americans or towards white people, whatever, I'm happy to tell them they're wrong. But I honestly think some of this stuff is kind of phony, and it's just the result of having no solidaristic class project. There is nowhere to channel your actual class solidarity these days, because you get to choose between two phony, false alternatives that are both faces of sort of neoliberal capitalism, right? And so, yeah, people end up squabbling over scraps, and it's it's just discourse wars at that point. Though there's nothing real sitting behind any of this.
Yeah, basically both MAGA and most of what's considered the left, including AOC, does fit. They basically are both products of the neoliberal framework.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's and this is not a new effect, right? It was Gore Vidal talked about in the 60s. You know, this America doesn't have two parties, two political parties. It just has one party. It's a party of capital with two right wings. And it doesn't seem like anything's changed there. We've changed some of the branding on each of them. But fundamentally, they just occupy the same part of this political spectrum, and there is no political choice in this country, at least not through electoralism.
Have you been following Amy Therese recently? She's been going after AOC. Primarily, this was on AOC's tweet, basically defending cancel culture. I don't have the AOC's tweet on me right now, but it basically saying that AOC, what she's basically said, is that the people who get canceled, they're the ones who have the power and something like that, which is like totally absurd. And then Amy Therese also touched upon AOC, actually, she's a lot of wealthy donors, especially from the tech industry.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly follow Amy. She has graced our podcast with her presence many times. I would dare to call her friend, perhaps. And yeah, I mean, you know, I think she's spot on in her analysis. I think she's often very very spicy and pugilistic in her approach to saying these things. But on AOC, I think she's exactly right, and she's had her number for a very long time in terms of sort of showing that, like, just wrapping the same product in a better style of rhetoric doesn't get you anywhere better, right? You, like, what is AOC's actual project? It's to say very nice things, and it ends up essentially generating a kind of legitimation for reasons why the left, as much as it exists, is allowed to get on board with Biden or with Nancy Pelosi's political program, because you've got AOC there giving it a nice, like, woke leftist spin. But that's all it is. There's nothing real sitting underneath that political project.
Well, also, she's been able to recapture a certain amount of the youth who've been disenfranchised by the Democratic Party and kind of draw them back into the party. I mean, we're seeing this now also with, like, the right wing, with, like, people like Madison Cawthorn, who's, like, considered, like, the AOC of the right. But they're all on the same project. They all will basically bend a knee to the Nancy Pelosi's and the Trumps of the world, because they don't actually want to rapidly change their reformists. But, like,
yeah, you interviewed the Shahid for Congress who's running against Nancy Pelosi, and obviously, I mean, Nancy Pelosi, she just epitomizes neoliberalism. So if I was a San Francisco voter, to me that would be such a clear choice to vote for Shahid. But as far as this new wave of progressive candidates running, how enthusiastic are you about them, or do you think they can end up being just like more like AOC's?
I mean, I've been very vocal and I get a lot of shit for it, but I'm sorry, I don't know if I can swear. I think the whole Rose Caucus, like, new progressive democratic socialist camp, whatever that means, I think they're losers. I think, like, we're seeing in the elections, none of them are winning, even like in the primaries when they ran up.
You're basically talking about the squad.
No, not just the squad. I mean, like, people like the Rose Caucus, like by people like
Joshua for Congress.
Congress. Yeah. But there's like, I think there's like 40 of them across the country, and all the ones that actually had votes lost, and they just keep going towards a leftism, which isn't class focused, but instead like an anarchism, liberalism, like identity politic, where all they do is just like say the most cringe like crap on the internet that no one cares about. Like, if I was running a campaign, I would never mention like Karl Marx or like weird like philosophers or stuff, because no one cares. And that's what these people are doing. Or they're just like being like, anyone who supported Trump or whatever, they're all Nazis. And it's like, that's not going to change anyone's mind. It's going to make them go more towards his camp. So they're just, they're not winners. They're losing.
I regard all of these as like, they are political aspirants, right? And they want something, you know, they want something out of this, either personally or as a political project, if you're taking a sort of, I guess, the most charitable reading. But I'm just not optimistic about any of their ability to affect change. You know, I think somebody like AOC, who is you know, probably a very well-intentioned person, has just very quickly been co-opted into a kind of Democratic Party politics, Democratic machine. She's got on board. And I think you'll just sort of see this, right? Either these candidates will be wacky outsider meme candidates who sort of exist with an online constituency that is extremely online, or they'll just get drawn into the same old tired status quo bullshit, but they'll be the ones who kind of try and awaken a little bit of, you know, radical or progressive energy and corral that back to the Democrats.
I mean, right now there is this new wave of cancel culture, and it's probably the most extreme it's ever been. And it's nothing, as it's not just people who are right wing or people who would be described by the left as racist. And now Chapo, which is one of the Bernie's major supporters, their Reddit got deplatformed, got taken down. But the thing is there's actually is a kind of civil war within the left. So you have kind of the old guard, range, a pretty wide range of people, from leftists like Noam Chomsky. We also have a lot of these center-left kind of neoliberal types like Barry Weiss. And they're signing this letter against cancel culture. And, I mean, the sort of tradition, the tradition of free speech that did exist on the left, and then a more kind of cynical, like that's the more, the kind of principal type, and then a sort of cynical Machiavellian view that if they think they control the institutions, and, by they, that's also kind of vague, because who am I talking about? Am I talking about the left, or am I talking about kind of neoliberal corporatists? But like those who do control institutions, like those tech monopolies, they're going to want to consolidate their power. And they're not going to want like that to be challenged. But yeah, I mean, what are your overall thoughts on this, the phenomenon of cancel culture, and what like forces you see behind it?
Yeah, I think the cancel culture, I mean, I guess I'll clarify what I think that means, is the like material punishment or complete deplatforming from like the kind of public spaces like the internet. But basically, I think Harper's letter. Like all these people limited their cancel culture to the media and academia, which I agree with. I think we need a media and academia who allows political difference and conversation, because they should be public spaces, but also kind of cuts off before, the working class industry. It's people who get fired because they have the wrong political thoughts, or they say the wrong thing, or they get filmed during like a meltdown because, I don't know, the world's a rough place. I think that needs to be addressed as well. But also, many people like Barry Weiss and stuff, like many of the people who have signed it have been shown to be hypocritical and have actually played active roles in deplatform people for like Palestinian struggle conversations.
For sure.
But also they don't want to address the elephant in the room, is that all of the spaces that they care about, like academia and the media, are just becoming further and further privatized, as well as the internet. And the real solution to there is making it like actually publicly owned, and they just actually just want to protect their class interests. They don't want any platform, but they don't want new people to come up, which is why they don't talk about working people being like canceled.
Oh, yeah. I mean, big tech ideally should be nationalized as a utility and then guaranteed more freedom of expression, freedom of speech. But I think there's an important point to make, is that cancel culture is a workers' rights issue, because there was this issue of called at-will employment, where it used to be that there were like stronger labor unions protecting workers' rights, and actually Republicans were the ones who pushed for making it easier for employers to fire their employees. But now the thing is that if there's stronger protections on workers' rights, and you can't just automatically fire someone without a really good cause, if those kinds of labor laws were put in place, then that would protect people from where someone can't lose their job for expressing an unpopular opinion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, there's both a, I think a, there's a sort of, like there's a platonic ideal of what free speech probably should be. And some of that is about like defending the ability to freely exchange ideas and to ensure that people actually approach the sort of, you know, a political disagreement on some kind of equal footing, and their ability to like, if I can say anything I want, but you actually can't respond to me without me being able to get you fired. Let's say I'm of independent means or whatever, so I can just say whatever I want. You can't cancel me, as it were. But you, I can get you fired from your job, and you can't eat anymore. Clearly, you're not good. We're not meeting on equal ground here. The tactical issue, though, for the left as it exists, is that who do they think this is going to be weaponized against? Like, do they think this is going to like we're going to be canceling the CEO of Raytheon? Of course not. It's going to be like some worker who's trying to start a union is going to say the wrong thing, and then there's an easy sort of HR approved way of firing them.
Yeah, I think short term. Remember like when Charlottesville happened and the people who attended lost their jobs. So I think right wing people were initially targets. But if this continues, I do think like long term, you'll actually see people losing their jobs for expressing more left wing economic views in the long term.
Oh, absolutely. Because the thing is, it's about what is disquieting to power. That's the mechanism that is operating there fundamentally. And yes, there are local aberrations where there are perhaps people who, parse some of the Charlottesville Unite the Right thing, you know, the guys with tiki torches who then were fired from their jobs at CVS or whatever, were done so fundamentally not for expressing the specific views. It's because the CVS corporation does not want the liability. They don't want to be associated with that. It's an inconvenience to their profits and their bottom line. It doesn't cost them anything to fire this person. There's no legal protections that would stop them firing them, so they fire them at their risk averse.
So when the guys from Charlottesville got fired, it's not so much that the corporate CEO was morally appalled by like racism on a personal level. It's more to do with the image of the guys with tiki torches was bad for their corporate brand.
Right, exactly. And as soon as the association between the guys with tiki torches being horrible, and to be clear, horrible, like, yeah, gross. These are not my political friends. Like, I regard them as enemies. But yeah, it's important to understand the mechanism here, which is that had that been sort of something they were just doing in their spare time, and CVS never needed to know or care about it, it would never have become an issue for CVS, say, or whoever their employers are. It was precisely that some people made a fuss about it, and the CVS can just take the risk minimizing HR approved path out, which say, yeah, we don't want the risk of our brand being tarnished by this. So why would we? Fuck you. You're just a worker. You're replaceable to us. You're fungible. But the problem is that the right wing are much better at having positions that are untroubling to corporations, whereas the left is often troubling to power if it's doing its job right, and will therefore run into this a lot more frequently than the right wing ever will.
There is this discussion of like building like a left-right alliance of like the dissident left, dissident right against like neoliberalism. And a lot of like third positionist or dissident rights types are, yeah, they're fans of like Amy Therese, Michael Tracy, and I'm sure your podcast to a degree as well. And then you could kind of get into the issue of, so you're talking about rejecting identity politics. And then we mentioned people before, so there, I mean, there's people who were like Bernie supporters who are allies with you on a lot of issues, but they're more into identity politics on the woke end. And then, you interviewed Perfume Nationalist Jack.
Yeah.
The thing is, he's anti-woke, but he's not really, he's more right-leaning, but he's not really into, he's not super into identity politics, unless you want to talk about, like, Perfume ads and 80s mall aesthetics. But what are your general thoughts on a alliance with, like, the dissident right or third positionist? Are you sympathetic to the idea, or do you think their version of identity politics could create a barrier?
I've been like on the politically organized like Marxist left for a very long time. So maybe it's just like that I have a bit of a spidey sense that tingles whenever people try and import what just reads like very right-wing reaction to me. And to be clear, that's where I'd say maybe some of the third positionists and things like that, like particularly if anybody starts getting into a lot of like racially stuff, I'm very uncomfortable and I probably don't want to break bread with them. I would say that our general approach is that it is better to be talking to people kind of regardless of whether you agree with them or not. And so that kind of line of discourse should be always kept open. And that's an unusual or controversial position on the left. And so that's why somebody like, you mentioned Jack, the Perfect Nationalist, doesn't have a particular political agenda, but like he's sort of considered canceled on, many parts of the woke left. And yet he's one of the nicest people you ever meet. He's incredibly sweet and his politics are really quite mild. And so it's like nothing, he would never say anything you wouldn't hear around a typical Thanksgiving table in America. So why is it we pretend he's the boogeyman or something? So, I think things, I'm always willing to hear people where they are. I would love to probably persuade them that, that there are political enemies are actually the same political enemies and that, some of these things are a bit of a cultural red herring. If it's like phony culture war shit that divides us, then I think you can talk your way past most of that.
I think also the ideological like alignment with like a left and a right, whatever that means nowadays, is kind of like the wrong way to approach it. The real approach is trying to address the actual suffering of all working people, regardless of political stances. So it's, I think a good example is like, for example, like the incel culture, which is like considered very right wing, and many people on the left are like, oh, none of your like your suffering or anything's real. It's all just like you because you're a loser and you're sad. But I think for me, it's more like, oh, when you look into who these people are, many of them are suffering because they lack economic opportunity. They're in parts of the country where there is no area of growth. They're in the dying like heartland. And I think we can no longer just ignore people's suffering. I think we can show maybe why their analysis is wrong, which it often is. But to just completely dismiss like people's worries, but like, oh, we're gonna lose our jobs by like open borders, or we're gonna all these men are like killing themselves, but that doesn't matter because like they're men or stuff like that. I just think isn't very useful. So in that way, I think just focusing on the class and their suffering is far more important than like a ideological alignment.
Oh yeah, like you mentioned that documentary TFW No GF, and
yeah,
I mean a lot of those men are in places, parts of the country that have been devastated by neoliberalism. The director, Alex Lee Moyer, she doesn't really, it's not a political documentary, so she doesn't put out her position, but I get the impression she's from a background that's basically like liberal in the sense of being for freedom of expression. But actually there were some kind of woke types like blue checks on Twitter who were saying that the documentary is like normalizing toxic behavior.
Totally. And that small L liberal notion that like it is better to talk about ideas and that there are not they're not ideas that are sort of so powerful or so scary that if by simply uttering their names, we will be defeated by them. And so, you know, to the extent that I feel like, yeah, there were people, the kind of blue check woke crowd who were very critical of that documentary, and yet I sort of saw it and I thought, God, how could you watch this and not just feel the utter dejection and suffering these people are feeling? And it's not because they're, you know, quote-unquote incels. It's because all their friends died of heroin overdoses or fentanyl overdoses, and they have no employment prospects. There is no economic security for them. They're sleeping on couches or whatever. Like, holy shit, why? Like, how could you sort of miss the forest for the trees there? In terms of, if what you're taking away from that is, gee, they're very edgy online and tell some jokes that are really not funny or not okay. Like, yeah, but look at their lives. I liked the documentary personally because I think it gets to the root of that, of saying there are just some bigger issues that transcend. And if what people are focusing on is like the jokes people tell or the words people use, they're telling you about their class project.
Yeah, I think another example of this is the movie Joker, because I would guess that if Joker came out, say, in the Bush era, it would be popularly portrayed as actually a leftist film. And Michael Moore, who was a leftist, like the left's icon of the Bush era, he actually liked the film. There are leftist themes about like class oppression, but it was remarkable how so many of the kind of neoliberal blue check types, they thought the Joker was, I mean, besides like the, obviously with the incel issue, that it was like an alt-right film.
Yeah, totally. And it's funny you mentioned the Joker during the Bush era, because V for Vendetta,
Wachowski siblings,
came out in 2005, right? The height of the Bush era, Bush paranoia, national security state ramping up, foreign wars, and the kind of the liberal, like the, I mean, really like the media class liberals of like Mother Jones and The Nation and New Statesmen, that sort of crowd, were just creaming themselves over this because it was, you know, wow, a sort of an insurrectionary mass politics to fight down the evil tyrant Bush. And it's so funny that in our current era, we've just sort of lost even any sense of irony or guile to sort of parse media as anything but like Democrats versus Republicans.
And yeah,
or
now
like,
the center left actually wants to rehabilitate. Like, you see George Bush going on Ellen, like they're trying to rehabilitate him. Yeah, I mean, he got us into like two really disastrous wars, and now he's like part of the resistance movement against Trump.
Right, and how absurd is that, given that man, you know, I lived through the Bush era, and my time, you know, my political radicalization came from the Iraq War, and I can't forgive anybody who wants to rehabilitate that man against, you know, bad orange Cheeto Man 45 or whatever. It's like,
you
know, we don't need to like either of them, but that guy has a lot of blood on his hands, and his body count is, you know, in the millions, and I can't believe we would just be like, well, it's politically expedient to pretend that he's actually good and cuddly because he sounded nice.
It's all about decorum. Who has the right decorum, whether as opposed to whether the policies, what impacts it has on people's quality of life or on human rights? Because a lot of the issue of Trump, I mean, I don't support him, but a lot of the opposition from like the neoliberal resist crowd is that his decorum, he has an ugly decorum. So yeah, with this election, we're obviously presented with two really bad choices, and the whole thing with the resist about Trump being like a Nazi and a Russian asset, I mean most of that stuff is all nonsense. But I mean, the problem with Trump, I see him as incompetent and continuing policies that benefit like the corporate oligarchy, as opposed to like his original working class base. The neoliberal critique of Trump is absurd.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, we see right now so much of the like establishment left being like, oh, anyone who votes for Trump, which I think is bad as well, is like, oh, they're racist and they're sexist and they're homophobes. But like, what do you say about the policies of the candidates you also supported, the Hillarys and the Bidens, who destabilized Libya, where now there's black people being sold as slaves? You have Syria, which is like integrated into like a partial Islamic state. or like even in Latin America, where right-wing like theocratic governments like Bolivia have taken power and just like had an utter disaster for not just women and gays, but like the like indigenous minorities. Like, if these people actually care about the small like identity groups they care about, they only care about it in the home country, the U.S. They don't care about it in like the Middle East or Russia or Africa or Latin America. They only care about their own interests. Like, they're narcissists.
Well, and I think it tells you a lot about the people who are very offended by Trump's decorum, but not by his actual actions, are telling you a lot about what their actual class project is. It's that their lives are not actually affected by Trump. It's, you know, he can sort of do whatever he wants. And,
yeah, I mean, but the thing is, like, a lot of those people, they'll actually kind of, they'll say tepidly, oh, I'm actually benefiting from Trump economically, but I hate what I hate his decorum.
Yeah, no, and that's they're saying the quiet part loud there by telling you that it does not matter to them who is part of the sort of, who's managing the consensus among a political, permanent political class that always benefits them, because they're kind of like part of a professional class that is just always going to be like, there are no downs. There's just sort of smaller ups and bigger ups. And the entire system works very well for them. So then they get incredibly indignant about the fact that, you know, the bad president man is not doing what the good president woman would have done or whatever. But like, it doesn't matter to them. This is all just theater and theatrics to them. And the people are still working 3 jobs, sleeping in their car, and dying of fentanyl overdoses in the rest of the country.
And just looking at Trump's actual policies, so he has done some good things. So one example is he did block that Trans-Pacific partnership, which Hillary was supporting, which would have been a disaster. And he was running on the trade issue. And but the thing is, like, he hasn't really brought that many jobs back from China as far as actual accomplishments, but he's done a few good things. But just looking at it, his handling of the pandemic has been pretty bad. Remember in the very beginning, so what actually happened is there were people like Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro, who were from the original kind of more populist wing of his support, were actually warning him to take it seriously. But he ended up taking the advice of like Wall Street types and like more the business wing of the GOP to not. They advised him against taking a harder lockdown, and he listened to that crowd. And then just looking at his handling of the stimulus, so there's these like PPP loans for COVID benefits, mostly benefiting people who already are very wealthy, and a meager stimulus for most. But what he should have done is like what they did in Germany. So in Germany, they made the stimulus conditional on keeping workers. So basically what happened under Trump, and that's obviously not just Trump, the whole political system is to blame. What happened is corporations laid off mass numbers of workers, but they still got tax cuts and stimulus.
Yeah, well, I think there's this myth that if we had Hillary or any other corporate Democrat as power, like, we'd have a massively different system, but I think we'd have quite the similar system. I mean, like, all the policies that Trump led off of were things that Obama passed through. Like, there was already children camps on the border. There's already, like, the most people, like, kicked out of the country under Obama. We have war escalation of every new president, like Bush, and then it was Obama, and now it's Trump. Like, Trump dropped the Moab in Afghanistan, like, the biggest bomb that's, like, short of, like, being a nuclear bomb. In regards to COVID, I think our system's kind of like set up to fail for this kind of catastrophe. We are a decentralized system, and even if like we had a Hillary in office, we've already seen states like Wisconsin, where I'm from, like, it wasn't Trump that overturned the lockdown and protections. It was the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. I think our system doesn't allow for a strong centralization authority to handle things like pandemics or mass suffering in like different areas, because it doesn't serve capital. Like, they want decentralization. It prevents like authoritative unity.
From our perspective, it's pretty obvious that Biden will continue to implement more of these disastrous like neoliberal policies. But what have been your personal experiences interacting with people on the left, including like the Bernie or bust crowd, and then versus the people who say vote blue no matter who?
I feel like that movement has kind of just melted away, and what remains is people who I think are just either deeply cynical, as in they, you know, just sort of don't see a path forward that isn't terrible, or there's people who got in line, right? They bought the good news story of like, well, Trump is the most dangerous president we've ever had. It was the Bernie campaign used that line over and over again, and I think disciplined a lot of people into the belief that you must choose between a very bad alternative and what they regard as a slightly worse one. As Sam said, it's not clear that the, you know, something like PPP loans would have been dealt with any differently under Biden, or that they will be dealt any differently under Biden. It's all the same market logic of small businesses and, employer tax breaks instead of, say, actual direct transfer payments to people. So, I don't know if there's an organized constituency there anymore to speak to in terms of the Bernie movement. The Bernie movement failed on its own terms. It has melted away. It doesn't even represent a pressure group anymore. As far as I can tell, it's a COVID charity now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always been the problem with the different candidates. Once their campaign's over, their movement dissolves and kind of gets absorbed into the establishment. I mean, this is pretty off topic, but I noticed you did a show where you talked about that whole kind of controversy. I mean, it shouldn't be a controversy, but with Glenn Greenwald and his husband, because it does seem like the left, the cultural left, used to be kind of libertines, and there seems to be this new trend, of shaming like large age gaps. So like, I mean, so Glenn Greenwald, I mean, they're both. So he was in his late 30s, and he met his husband when he was 19. So, I mean, obviously they're both consenting adults, but some of these people, they think that what consenting adults do, they literally act as if it's the moral equivalent of Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, that was surreal to watch, and I mean, what a new moral panic that is. To be clear, I mean, if Glenn Greenwald and his husband, if there's something wrong there, I mean, I don't know what you want. He's living the dream in terms of they have adoptive, you know, a beautiful adoptive children for many years, and they've been in a relationship for many years, and 100,000 dogs or whatever they have, their weird dog farm.
He's really big in animal rights, so he has a lot of animal rescues.
Right. Well, so you have to imagine, like, what is it you would want from a relationship? If you're talking about these sorts of like traditional family structures or whatever, like they did it. They played the game to the letter, and they did the thing, you know, that supposedly everyone's meant to do. And the fact that you just have these, I mean, don't forget, these are mostly very young people who are being incredibly censorious about this online, and basically going, "Ooh, ick. 37-year-old dating a 19-year-old? That's disgusting." It's like, well, I mean, whatever. I suppose you're entitled to that opinion, but you're just wrong. These are adults, and you know, I wish them well, right? And anybody who's gonna spend a lot of time fixated on somebody else's relationship, I think, is manifesting a kind of pathology.
I think one of you joked that in the future we're gonna have an app that calculates power dynamics.
Well, yes, I think I was saying something about how would you even date somebody born on a different day or in a different year? How would that even work? I don't know how that could happen. And I think, yeah, so Sam famously dates outside his age range, and so
I always joke that my like first boyfriend was like 28 when I was 18, and I asked them out, and it's like, to these people that would be problematic, but the whole situation breaks their narrative, because I guess I was the groomer.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, even if the whole twink genre, if there's like a push to cancel that.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a whole, like, especially in the gay world, I think having the age gap is so less of a thing, because there is a much smaller pool of gay people in the entire population than in the straight population. So like in the straight world, you often find a person very similar, but in the gay world, to find someone of mutual interest, you might have to like do your range of like maybe older, like if you're like older, maybe like a few years younger. I mean, clearly it's not everyone's an adult. That's what's important.
And also with the whole idea that everyone has to reach certain goal points by a certain age, like I think that's kind of that's ridiculous. Everyone is on their own personal journey in life, and it's also possible someone who's younger could have a lot more like life experience or street smarts.
Right. Well, but isn't it such a wonderful demonstration of a kind of a liberal moralism that regards people as kind of a proxy for a concept? It's not like these aren't real people to these people, right? They're expressing an abstract concern for a category of person who is younger dating a category of person who's older.
Yeah.
It's not saying the specific people in this case, right, of like Glenn Greenwald and his husband, clearly were both consenting, well-intentioned. It worked out really nicely. They're happy together. There's no allegation that there's any sort of coercion or abuse there. This is a good relationship. But they don't care. It's because people aren't real people. They're just sort of these, like...
This goes back to what we said at the beginning of the show. Like, the kind of... I mean, there's different influences. You could say, like, wokeness is like a kind of... is like a new religion. But I think the main point I would make is that basically, like, everything in our society is like a marketing or advertisements decision. So basically, like, relationships are also... business transactions are a form of marketing. Like, the whole concept of, like, self-branding.
I think also for a lot of these young people, they have a misplaced utopianism of the possibility in our modern world to have an egalitarian dating pool. The idea that there isn't going to ever be, like, income disparities or, like, economic disparities or, like... numerous disparities between, like, power. I mean, clearly to some where it's, like, just outright coercive, like a teacher and a student, but in the rest of the world, like, there will always be in, like, division of, like, oh, maybe one person has more money than the other, and is that coercive? I guess in a way it could be, but, like, at a certain point, everything's just you kind of get to, like, the Maoism online of, like, all sex is, like, coercive, and I don't think that's very helpful. You're not going to win a working class by saying all of your marriages are bad. No one should be having sex anymore. Like, that's not going to work. And these people just kind of don't see the fact that their utopian ideals are possible because they're not addressing the deep economic reality of, like, why there is disparities between people and relationships in the first place.
And, Sam, you were saying that you were interested in visiting Chechnya. The autonomous zone of Russia. I guess it's called, people are calling it Sharia Vegas.
Yeah, that was
a friend and TwinGrev contributor, River Page, who writes some articles for us.
I follow him on Twitter.
Yes, he's great, and we were recording, and Sam had just tweeted some photos of the capital of Chechnya, saying he wanted to visit. He said, "Oh, have fun in Sharia Vegas."
It's kind of interesting about, like, politics and aesthetics and how people online have this tendency to link a political ideology with one kind of clear aesthetic. So it's kind of interesting to kind of mix and match. So you could have, like, a society that is ultra socially conservative, but then have the visual aesthetics or the architecture might capture something entirely different. It might symbolize, like, when I saw that, I guess, I mean, what came to mind is, a lot of newer cities are kind of bland, like, it's just nothing, but just, like, just kind of glass boxes, but it did kind of make me think of, like Vegas in the 80s.
and I think one of the things that people fall into about being, say, Marxists in the, you know, the 2000s or 2020s is, you know, the... there's a way to get into a sort of anachronism or almost a cosplaying nature. And I've always sort of said, so I was raised in New Zealand, but I'm also an American citizen. I kind of like this place.
Because I basically assumed you were American, but then I was analyzing your pronunciation, and you slip into the British pronunciation occasionally.
Yeah, no, I was born in the U.S. To New Zealand parents, and then raised in New Zealand, and I came back. So it gets a little mixed. But you know, so I've always said that, like, to be a Marxist in America is actually a special kind of gift, because if you buy any of this sort of American exceptionalism argument, we should be able to do it better than anybody else. You know, we should be able to do the best Marxism you know, folks, it'll be the best. It's best Marxism. And so that, you know, when you start thinking about the aesthetics of what is the society you might want to build, it doesn't have to be Soviet. It can be American.
I mean, so many people are rigid, like both like the trad types and the Marxist type, they're rigid about what has to be the ideal aesthetic. I think you can borrow the best from, obviously, capitalism is flawed, but there's still great innovations or aesthetics that have emerged from capitalism, like Vegas, for instance.
Totally, and I love Vegas. Sam loves Vegas. We go to Vegas when there's not a pandemic on quite often because it's convenient for us. And yeah, I mean, even Marx was very complimentary about the capability of capitalism to build amazing things. And that's, I think, the difference between a sort of a long-suffering, self-flagellating liberal left, which is all about self-abnegation and denial. It's like, no, we want luxury, but we just want it to be broadly distributed and controlled by the people who create that luxury.
Oh, yeah, like the kind of like fully automated luxury communism. I think that
has a little, you know, there are some pitfalls in some of that where some of that rhetoric can try and skip some steps about how we actually, you know, there's a lot we have to do to get there. But I do think that's a worthy goal to think about it as like, it doesn't have to be suffering and breadlines. It should be the best parts of luxury, you know, high-end luxury Vegas, but for everybody.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I like aesthetics. I like things that are pretty because I'm a gay, so I'm simple. but I do think the narrative is that socialism or like the Soviet model only produced like this disgusting, brutalist architecture and design, which they did some of that, but also like they housed everyone, but also like produced some of the most beautiful forms of like public spaces, like the Moscow subway system, or like Minsk in Belarus, which is like part of the former Soviet, is like a very beautiful city full of parks and like basically creating beauty for everyone. I think the left has kind of ignored that because they view beauty as like a right wing kind of conception. But the reality is like, if we want public spaces for all, why make them like ugly? Why have like the McDonaldization of like housing and like public spaces, and we can have beautiful public spaces for everyone to enjoy. It's why I felt like Chechnya was cool. It's like, oh, this place is, it's never talked about, but it's like extremely like cool. It's like a Vegas. It's like a Vegas place that people can enjoy and you just wouldn't expect.
Well, it's unique. It's about not erasing all difference. And I think that's the problem with neoliberalism, particularly its American manifestation, is it's about reducing all difference to the sort of optimal market solution. Instead of saying, you know what, I want some ugly buildings and some weird buildings, and I want some buildings that are Greco-Roman columns mixed with, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I want it all.
Like,
I want it all.
I
want
difference. If you follow Jack, like, he talks about, I mean, I share this passion with him, but, like, 80s mall aesthetics, how there were these mass kind of renovations, which he did, these minimalist renovations he describes as a neoliberal aesthetic, where everything is just, like, all, like, glass, gray, these kind of minimalist shapes. And then you kind of get this trend like through globalization as well, where like all cities start to look the same. So with aesthetics, like you don't have to be rigid. You can pick and choose the best from different things. But I would actually say the same with political systems. Like I wouldn't advocate a pure form of any system, whether it's Marxism or capitalism. You just have to kind of look at like what works and what doesn't. And then take maybe the best ideas from Marxism, but also maybe borrow some things from capitalism or other political systems too.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, I mean, I feel like Marxism in any pure incarnation has to be considered a natural outgrowth of the capitalism you find. That's the problem, is people try and consider it some like alternative to capitalism. It's not. It's meant to be a progression beyond, but it must be a product of it.
Yeah. I think both liberals and conservatives, they assume that capitalism and Marxism are the only two systems, but Marxism comes after capitalism, but there were systems before that, like agrarianism, which pre-existed that, so it's kind of this duality that you either have capitalism or Marxism.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the things people ignore most about a lot of the earlier socialist state projects, is that only like two of them were actually industrialized and the rest were all semi-feudalist or like agrarian societies, which is not what Marx talked about. So they have to overcome a massive industrialization period, which for any country is going to be quite devastating to the population. It depends on how devastating it will be. And I'd say in some cases it was actually probably better maintained through a state central planned development versus like the capital system where it's kind of like, fuck all of you. If you decide, you can make more babies. Like, that's what's going to happen. Yeah. But like places like East Germany were industrialized, and once they rebuilt after like World War II, like they had lots of the luxuries we enjoy now today, like bars and social spaces and like education and stuff. I think this idea we need to have a one system fits all is just un-Marxist because it ignores the material and historical realities of different places. Like what's going to work in Vietnam is going to be very different than like the U.S. Like Vietnam had the war, they have parts of their land destroyed, and that's why like Ho Chi Minh swap emerged, or like Romania had their own kind of like extension of Marxism, or even like Marxist-Leninism was designed for the Soviet, like Russian Empire system. So like we can't pretend that American socialism will ever look like any of those, because we're so different. We're the empire. Like we're not going to look like.
Well, we want drive-throughs. Just to be clear, I mean, I don't want to be part of any revolution that does away with the notion of drive-through convenience entirely, because it's an American right, you know, and I love it. So, you know, it doesn't have to be one size fits all.
For sure. We're getting close to the end of the show. Sam and Jan, do you want to plug your podcast website? And if you have any upcoming projects you can comment on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the podcast is Twink Revolution. It's available where all good podcasts are sold. And then twinkrev.com is where you find a bunch of interesting writers and publishing projects. And you can see what we're up to there.
Sam and Gian, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having us.